Well, good evening, everyone. I'm Steve Lee. I'm an alcoholic. You know, I hate to come right out of the gate having to correct Wynn on a few things, but it's just it's necessary. And clearly, we don't go to the same barber. My barber wouldn't leave that stuff undone that he has left. And half measures have availed him nothing. And I likewise have to clear up the fact that that I'm not from Nashville. I'm actually from Brentwood, and that's not very important to me, but the people in Nashville want you to know I'm from Brentwood. And they're very concerned in Nashville about what I might say or do up here and don't want to be attached to any of that this evening. But the truth is I'm really pleased and privileged to be invited to participate and hang out with you guys this weekend, and I really do appreciate it. And my experience has been that I will leave here different than the guy that showed up here, and I will get more than I give. And you'd be amazed how many people confirm that for me on the way out of town. But anyway, as my sponsor says, you know, and my sponsor's Don M. from Louisville, and Don was originally going to be part of this program as well, but he had some very serious brain surgery just barely a month ago, had multiple blood clots, and he's just had a remarkable recovery. So he's doing great. But as Don always says and reminds me, that the only thing that differentiates me from you guys in terms of me being behind the podium tonight is, on this occasion, I'm the guy that was invited, and that mistake doesn't often happen twice in the same area. But anyway, I'm going to try to do what you've invited me to do, and what our what Alcoholics Anonymous is about at its core is one alcoholic sharing with another. And tonight I'll do most of the talking, but it's still just sharing my story of the things that were going on in my life and with me before I got to AA, what happened to nudge me this direction, and a little bit about what life has been like in AA and today. And what I've discovered over the years is I realized that, I'm not necessarily going to tell you what happened. I'm going to tell you my experience of what happened. I've discovered that often other people around me were having a different experience at the same time. And we would describe it differently. And so while I am 100% committed to being honest with you tonight, I don't have the same commitment to accuracy. I'm often honestly mistaken. I went to South Carolina a few years ago to a conference, and my host had called, and we had talked on the phone a few times, just like Wynn and I had, but we had never met, and I was flying in, and he was going to meet me at the airport. And I got there, and I was around baggage. I'd gotten my bag, but he and I weren't connecting with each other. We just couldn't find each other. We're calling on our cell phones, and he said, "Steve, I'm right over here by, baggage carousel number 6. And I said, "Man, you can't be. I was just there." I said, "In fact, I'm walking over there right now. I don't see." He said, "No, I'm right here." And finally, I see a guy on his phone, and we realized the reason we had not been able to connect with each other is we'd both described ourselves as much more attractive than we really are. And so in a very real sense, what I recognize is how I see myself is not always how other people see me. And how I see you is perhaps, so none of us have the whole story. None of us can see it all. Even as we get to, as I land around the second step and begin to explore this relationship with a higher power, it says no one can fully define or comprehend that power which is God. So if I go and try to describe you to someone else, I'm only going to have part of the story. And I think the same thing is true. And I realized that I'd been living so much of my life on bad information. My sponsor, Frank, shared with me one time. He said, "Steve, here's the news, buddy." He says, "You're not who you think you are. And you're not who they think you are. And you're sure as hell not who you think they think you are." And see, what I would tell you is that unknowingly, not consciously, but before I get to Alcoholics Anonymous, and often today, I will give an exaggerated importance to what I think you think, and then try to become the person that I think I need to be for you to think the right thing about me. And so what you've told me is I'm wrong about what I think you think, so that's a waste of my time. The real opportunity for me here at Alcoholics Anonymous is not to become a different person. It is through the process of these 12 steps to free me of the bondage of self so I can become who I really am. I've discovered that that power which can change me will not make me other than who I am. So I'm trying to be freer of those things that block me off from me and block me off from that power. Alcohol did that for me for a long time. It at least put me at ease with me. It made me comfortable. You know, I discovered that when I drank, I felt good and acted bad. And when I didn't drink, I acted good and felt bad. And it became more important for me to feel good than to act good. I made a lot of mistakes when I was drinking. I did a lot of things to hurt a lot of people, but it was necessary for me to do it. And I want to say, too, before I go too much further, I don't know if there are many new people in the room, but sometimes it sounded to me, when I listened to people speak from the podium or even in meetings early on when I was sober, it sounded to me like when they were talking that they knew what was going on. They were able to articulate this life that they'd had as if they recognized all this as they were going through it. I can't speak for other people, but I can tell you life was just happening to me. I didn't get a voice, and I couldn't give voice to my alcoholism until after I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And you guys began to share your stories with me, and I would go, that's it. And I began to be able to look back and begin to understand that's what was going on. I didn't consciously recognize a lot of what was happening for me when I was going through it. So I'm going to try to do what you invited me to do, but what you already know, if you've just paid any attention, is that I don't have a clue what I'm going to talk about, and I'm certainly not going to do it in any, you know, particular chronological order. If I think of something to say, I'm just going to say it, and sometimes it's divinely inspired, and sometimes it's self-indulgent, you'll just have to try to separate the wheat from the chaff yourself. But I'm more open to that today. You know, I'm more open to recognizing that if I do, if I ask God to help get me out of the way, that the truth about me might show up in ways I didn't expect. You know, I called my wife from a conference. I was back in April. I was with some friends up in Virginia at a conference, and I just gave what it felt like a terrible talk. You know, I called my wife the next morning, and I said, I just gave a terrible talk last night. And she says, I hope you didn't talk at all. She says, I hope it was God talking. And I said, well, in the hospitality room, they're blaming me for God's talk. And you may do the same later, you know. Look, I've got a sobriety date, and it's June 30th, 1989, that means for me that the last time I've had a drink was June the 29th of 1989. I don't know if it's the last drink I'll have, but it's the last time I've had a drink. And my sponsor, Frank, explained to me that sobriety date, while it's very important, it's a measurement of time from my last drink to today. But it does not measure my spiritual condition on any given day. My spiritual condition is much like the stock market that goes up and down and dips. I just hope over time that I'm a stock that's trending up, even though I have particular days where the market crashes pretty regularly. So I've got that sobriety date, and I've got a home group. It's the backroom group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Meets every Saturday and Sunday morning at both 9 a.m. and 10:30 at 5925 O'Brien Street in Nashville. The people in Brentwood like to send me off to Nashville to the meetings I go to. So if you're ever there, come join us. I think it's a great group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have great meetings. And that's critically important. But the reason it's my home group is because of the activity between meetings and the outreach and the work with correctional facilities and treatment facilities and our fellowshipping one with another and including our families and some social events. It's an active group of Alcoholics Anonymous beyond our meetings. And that's important to me. So I'm real grateful to be a member there. I told you my last time I've had a drink was June the 29th of 1989. I'm going to share with you now what's always the most embarrassing part of my story. It's people are already giggling at me on the front row. You know, I got to tell you, to some of you folks in the back, this may look like the front row. From here, it looks very much like judgment row. And looks like you got everything but place cards ready to give a score, you know. And the Russian judge is pretty tough over here. And you know, it's a fairly tough crowd here. I've looked around. There's some bad alcoholics in here. Some of you got here, you know, just in time. And some of you not quite. And my last drink was an amaretto on the rocks. And it's shameful to me to have to share that with you. No, I'm appropriately embarrassed by that. And had it occurred to me that for some years after that I would regularly be telling that to an assembled group, I would have had a different drink. But what you now know is I didn't know that was going to be my last drink when I had it. I had no intention of stopping drinking. Now, what was happening was I was scheduled into a treatment facility on July the 1st of 1989. And not because I'd decided to stop drinking or thought I even needed to stop drinking. Not because I'd had some epiphany. Not because I was looking for some moral uplift in my life. I was simply going to fulfill my obligation to the legal system of Williamson County, Tennessee, for the conviction of my 6th DUI a year before. And as part of a plea bargain arrangement, they had given me jail time, and then they had agreed to cut some of that jail time off if, as part of my the terms of my probation, if I would go to drug and alcohol rehabilitation. And, you know, one sounded about as bad to me as the other, but I agreed to do that, and July the 1st is when that was going to start. And on June the 29th, my wife and I went out with three other couples, just kind of a last hurrah. It wasn't even a big drunk for me. My friend Ricky, who lives down here in Atlanta now in Ackworth, Ricky's the one that got embarrassingly drunk that night, and I've never been able to get. He's come to AA, listened to me talk a few times, but I said, Ricky, remember that night? Man, you're the problem. Ricky came by on June the 30th, the next day, my wife and I were going to spend that day with our daughter Abby, who was 5 years old at the time, before Daddy was going to go away on a 28-day business trip. And we took Abby to Chuck E. Cheese, you guys have heard it too. I don't have a very tough story. I'm not a tough guy. I'm not a street smart guy. I mean, the night I got that last DUI in Brentwood, I had gone the wrong way down a little residential street and hit a Brentwood police officer's car, and that'll get you arrested. And but it's clear I'm not street smart because I tried to bribe the officer. They tell me, and that's not such a bad plan. But I tried to do it with a check, and apparently that has to be a cash transaction to be effective. But now on June the 30th of 1989, my wife and I are taking our daughter Abby to Chuck E. Cheese. And while I'm not a tough guy, I will share with you, if you have not sobered up yet, do not spend your first day sober at Chuck E. Cheese. It was a hellish day at Chuck E. Cheese. You know, it's loud in there, and they are short and coming at you from every angle. And just as I'm gathering my emotional equilibrium, I see a 6-foot mouse in the back of the room, and I ask Connie, I'm trying hard not to see this mouse, and I said to Connie, I said, baby, do you see the mouse? And she said she did in her kindest, loving voice, and she was sharing the love with me that day. And our friend Ricky comes by on July the 1st to drive me off to this treatment facility. And the other thing I want to say is that I hope we have some laughter tonight, and our book says that laughter and cheerfulness make for usefulness. But again, if you're new, I know most of you know this, but if you're new, I want you to know none of this was funny while it was happening. There was nothing funny about any of this while it was happening. What I can do today from this this vantage point is look back at my life and see the absurdity of it as I was living it. But as our book says, when I was going through it, I couldn't differentiate the true from the false. And while I saw that my alcoholic life was injurious, it seemed the only normal one. I couldn't anticipate. I didn't know how to think my way out of this problem. I couldn't see things in proportion to what they really were. One of the descriptions of insanity in our book is right after, you know, Jim pours the milk in his whiskey. And he says, what can this lack of proportion or the ability to think straight be called but insanity? And that's what I love that description, because what I recognize looking back, and sometimes today, what I have is a lack of proportion. I respond disproportionately to the events of my life. Sometimes I over-respond, sometimes I under-respond, even today. Sometimes I'll do that flippant thing that hurts my wife or my daughter. Sometimes I'll say that cutting remark to someone and be clueless about it. And what can this be called but insanity? An inability to see and recognize some of these things. But anyway, my buddy Ricky's driving me over there, and I've just got a host of emotions going on. I'm angry that I have to go. I think this is unfair. I just didn't think I'm a guy that has to do this. Somehow, and again, it sounds absurd to say it, but I thought this, you know, I'm the kind of guy you just give a stern talking to and straighten out, you know. But I don't have to go to jail, which I had to do. I had to spend jail time, and I don't have to go to treatment. And that's for those kind of people. And see, when I was in jail, I thought I was different than the people in jail. And when I was in treatment, initially, I thought I was different than those people in treatment. I'm a visitor to this strange land. You know, somehow you belong here, but I'm different. And when I got to AA, I thought I was different than the people in AA. And I will tell you today, unabashedly, that I am so grateful to be amongst you. I feel so fortunate not to feel different, but to feel a part of. You know, somewhere in my first year of sobriety, when I wasn't even paying attention, I turned from a guy that had to that couldn't drink to a guy that didn't drink. And I turned from a guy that had to go to AA to a guy that gets to go to AA. I feel so blessed to get to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous, which in turn allows me to be a part of the world at large. I don't want to be limited to AA, but it's the gatekeeper to the rest of my life. Anyway, Ricky's driving me over there, and he said, Steve, what do you think this deal's going to be like? I said, I don't know, man. I don't have a clue. I said, but I'll tell you one thing. I said, I'm not getting in some little circle going, I'm Steve, I'm an alcoholic, and whine about the most intimate details of my life to a bunch of strangers, you know. And I said, about the third week in that treatment facility, I was just telling people way more than they wanted to know about me. You know what I mean? They just took the cap off Pandora's box for me. I just puked emotionally all over everybody. I started making stuff up, too, because you got to. Because I'll be honest with you, Amaretta and Chuck E. Cheese will get you no street cred in the treatment center. You got to bring in a little harder than that. But you know what? It's true. It's absurd, but it's true. I did do that stuff. And here's what I've discovered and why I'm committed to trying to be as honest as I can with you tonight. Our book says, in working with others, we tell the new man exactly what happened to us. And what I recognize is that the primary thing of value that I bring to Alcoholics Anonymous is the truth about me. Whatever that truth is, and my story's not going to resonate with everyone, it's not going to sound like everyone else's, it's just going to be what it is, and it's going to find the target it's supposed to find. And that's why over time all of us are encouraged to tell the truth about ourselves, whether it's from the podium, whether it's in our AA meetings, whether it is over coffee somewhere. Ultimately, one alcoholic sharing with another honestly and openly about his or her experience is at the core of Alcoholics Anonymous. So that's what I'll try to do tonight, and I'll try not to tell any lies. They won't happen on purpose. They'll happen. So Ricky drops me off, and I walk into that treatment facility, and they gave me a test right out of the gate. Some of you have had versions of it. They call it an assessment. It felt like a test to me, and they asked me a host of questions in an effort, I know looking back, to assess if I was alcoholic and or drug addict, and if so, at what level. They had different a grading scale. And they had a variety of different questions, and a section of this assessment was 30 questions that all began with the phrase, "Have you ever?" You're right, it's overly stringent right out of the gate. And they went like, "Have you ever?" which they explained to me meant even once, and even with a really good reason. Have you ever drank alone? Have you ever drank in the morning? Have you ever had a DUI? Have you ever had a blackout? Have you ever had trouble at home because of drinking? Have you ever had trouble at work because of drinking? 30 have you ever questions, where they just have check yes or check no to what are clearly essay questions. These are answers that beg for an explanation. Not just, how can you, and again, we're laughing. I got to tell you, that morning, I can't make myself check that box. How can I do this? How can I check this box? Because I know they're going to draw conclusions about me based on this. And how can you do that without the backstory? How can you do that without the information? I mean, have you ever drank in the morning? So I had questions about the questions. I said, "So, what do you mean morning?" And because I think it's a reasonable question, because 12:01 a.m. is technically the morning, and I'm thinking, see, because I think I know what they're asking, right? Clearly, what they're wondering is if I'm that guy that's got, you know, that derelict alcoholic that's waking up at 4 or 5 in the morning and has to grab that half pint off the nightstand and take a pull off of it just to get the day going, just to be able to get to the bathroom. But what if I'm up a little late drinking at a very nice establishment to last call at 2 a.m.? Don't confuse me with that guy. Have you ever drank alone? Well, yeah, you know, but they left. And because I know what they're asking, right? I think they're asking, "Hey, man, are you that guy that's got to come home, that's got to pull the shades and lock the door and unplug the phone and drink in isolation by yourself, afraid from the world?" And while certainly I've done that a few times, not so often I'm checking it on this test. And and there's another kind of alone drinking, you know. I'm the kind of guy that had to drink to go drinking. You know, I got to have a few drinks at home so I show up ready to play. You can't go cold right into that environment. And what if, by the way, what if I'm in the car alone driving over to the party or the club, but there are other cars on the road? Is that alone drinking? Now, look, in this crowd, the laughter here, I think, is a knowing laughter. That sounds, it sounds absurd. It sounds absurd, but see, those are the types of, that stuff is running through my head because I don't know how to check this box. But there's a line back in the story, Freedom from Bondage, and she talks about rationalization. And she says rationalization is given a socially acceptable explanation for socially unacceptable behavior, and that's a form of insanity. And what I didn't realize, I mean, I look back and see that I've spent a great deal of my life trying to provide an acceptable explanation for me, trying to explain those things I've done. Sometimes it seemed to have something to do with what I did, and sometimes I'm just building a case to protect myself. And sometimes I'm providing that rationalization to the people in my life, to my wife, to my mother, to my daughter, to my brother. And sometimes, and toward the end, more often, I'm providing that explanation to myself. I've got to convince me of the socially acceptable reason to do these things, to be able to live with the man I'd become, doing the things I was doing, hurting the people I was hurting, betraying the trust I was betraying. I've got to find a way to convince me that this is okay. And it got harder and harder. Anyway, I didn't do well on the test. But here's what I've discovered, and thank goodness the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous let me know right away that how I answered the questions on that test is not what makes me alcoholic. Those are the types of questions which might reveal alcoholism. They might expose it. They might shine a light on it. But that's not what makes me alcoholic. That is the evidence of alcoholism. What makes me alcoholic, I believe, is that when I honestly want to, I can't stop entirely. And when I drink, I can't control the amount I take. I'm unpredictable. And because of that, all of those types of things happen to me. And if we all took that test, different ones of us would answer different questions differently. So there's no particular litmus test relative to the circumstances and consequences of my alcoholism. If I'm looking for those things, I might find a way to get out of here. One of the questions was, you know, have you ever had a blackout? Now, I'm a blackout drinker. It didn't require much for me to black out, but I just lost time regularly. I love the comedian Dave Attell said he's a blackout drinker, as he likes to call it time travel. And I get that because that's the way I just go, whoa, you know, how did I get here in the future and what has been going on? And then I'm the guy that's trying to fill in the blanks of that night before, you know, by not asking direct questions to people. You're trying to read their faces and how did it go? And was I just kind of cute last night or did I go way off in the weeds, you know? And it's a tiring, exhausting way to live. But I spent an inordinate amount of time trying to do that, trying to figure it out. How did I do? Oh, anyway. I'm going to go back a little bit and tell you about that, a little bit of the drinking and a little bit of my life before I got to that treatment facility. Then we'll sober up for a little while. I was born and raised in Smyrna, Tennessee. Smyrna's just about 30 miles out of Nashville and a small town, about 5,000 people back in, I'm 60 years old next month, so it was about 5,000 people when I was coming up there in the early 50s. I came from a middle-class family, no circumstantial reason to be alcoholic. I mean, middle-class deal, mom and daddy were together, nobody was hitting anybody, you know. They're alcohol, my mom and dad were drinkers, but alcohol didn't seem to have a major role in our life. I saw it regularly, it wasn't important to me, it didn't seem like a big deal, I don't have a clue. I got an older brother, an older sister, a younger sister, I was a good kid. I went where I said I was going to go. I was with who I said I was going to be with. I came home when I said I was going to come home. My mother tells a story. My brother, who's 4 years older than me, when he was, you know, real little and in the playpen, they had to put a big piece of plywood over the playpen to keep him in. He wanted to get out and go do stuff, you know. And shit on me, they just put a blanket out, and I just crawled to the edges of the blanket and not get off of it. Now, here's what I know. I spent most of my life up until I was 18, 19 years old crawling to the edge of the blanket and not getting off of it, but wanting desperately to get off of it, but afraid and afraid to draw negative attention to myself. And I'm the guy that I wanted to be a badass. I just couldn't. You know, I wanted to be a bad actor, but I couldn't. I was afraid to do it. And I was a pretty good kid. You know, our book says if the mere code of morals and philosophy of living were sufficient, many of us would have recovered long ago. And I had a code of morals and I had a philosophy of living and they were sufficient. Right up to the moment they were no longer sufficient. And I don't look, you know, I knew the kind of guy I wanted to be. I knew how I wanted to, you know, what was important to me, and I was able to adhere to that right up until I wasn't able to. And I don't know that a guy like me sees that happening. So I didn't drink in high school or anything or do any drugs. And then I'm a freshman in college, and two buddies came by one night to go back to a high school basketball game. As I'm in the back seat of a 1968 Volkswagen Bug, and they hand back a bottle of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill wine. Okay, now you've offended me. Now, I hear the groans about the Boone's Farm, and You know, this AA is a pretty remarkable place. Because collectively, we will, in our AA meetings, oh, we just talk about stuff. You know, oh, I got, you know, three wives in two states, and I've held up six 7-Elevens. You know, oh, but I didn't drink Boone's Farm. And where you guys will plant your flag is just amazing to me. But I know so far that this is a grisly story I'm telling with Amaretta Boone's Farm and Chuck E. Cheese. And clearly I've risen like a phoenix from the ashes. This is a story of redemption unequaled. There's a movie in here somewhere. They hand back at Bala Boone's Farm, Strawberry Hill, and I take a sip. You know, I'd had a sip of Daddy's beer before, and you know, I'm sure I'd had a sip of the martini my mom regularly made him and that kind of stuff, but I don't recall anything there. But that night, I had that experience with alcohol. I drank with purpose, and I had enough of it, however much that was, that by the time we got where we were going, the feeling was I couldn't wait to get there. Because I thought you couldn't wait to see me when I got there. I had never felt that at ease and that comfortable. Our book in one place calls alcohol, among other things, a social lubricant. And that quite clearly was what was happening to me that night. It literally, instead of being the ball in the pinball machine that just feels like I'm bumping into everything and everything is staticky and hard, I'm lubricated. I'm moving easily amongst you. I'm comfortable. I say now my motor skills were badly diminished, but I felt good, and I blacked out that night. I can't tell you whether I was alcoholic just before I took that drink, and whether I was alcoholic just after I took that drink. Or at what point I became alcoholic. I don't know. I've got some opinions, but I don't know. Because I don't know if I drank alcoholically from that moment on, because I drank so enthusiastically from that moment on. And see, if I'm not trying to exercise any power, I don't know if I have any. If I'm not trying to moderate my drinking, I don't know if I can. If I'm not trying to stop and not start again, I don't know if I can. Our book says in the doctor's opinion that while they have no way of proving it, many of them believe they could have stopped early in their drinking career. And I think the reason they had no way of proving it is the same reason I don't. They didn't try. But the time a guy like me reaches the point where I think, hey, I either need to stop or slow down or moderate or try not to let that happen again, I'm beyond human aid. Now, I don't know that. I don't know lack of power is my dilemma. I don't know that I've got a physical allergy that brings with it the phenomenon of craving. I never once was out at a bar having a few drinks and turned to the guy next to me and went, I don't know about you, pal, but that phenomenon of craving's kicking in on me. Whoa, lack of power is my dilemma. I didn't have language for my alcoholism. I did not know what the problem was. I knew I drank. I knew that I got in trouble when I drank. I knew that sometimes, you know, drinking was a problem. When I was in that treatment facility and they were going around that first day that I was there and people were introducing themselves and I'm the new kid on the block and people are saying, hey, I'm Bob, I'm an alcoholic, and the next person in our little group was Betty and she was alcoholic and an addict and people were various things as it's coming around and I don't know what to be. I don't know what to say. I don't want to be alcoholic. I didn't know much about alcoholism, but I knew if I said out loud I'm alcoholic, somebody's going to suggest I not drink anything at all. And that is a gross overcorrection to the problem I got. Because, see, I don't know that there weren't many times. There's one time that I'll tell you about before I'm done that I've decided to stop drinking altogether. But usually I was going to do better. And see, if you don't know anything about alcoholism, that seems like a reasonable response. I'm going to try harder. I'm going to come at it from a different direction. I'm not going to let that happen again. I was spending a lot of time trying not to let that happen again. I won't drink so much that I cause this level of damage or harm or embarrassment or shame to me and the people around me. So I'm going to avoid these consequences. But the thought of not drinking, I didn't know. I was clueless. It was a wonderful piece of information to me when I got to AA and heard about the allergy to alcohol. As it says in the doctor's opinion, you know, it says the doctor's theory that we had an allergy interested us, for it explained that for which we could not otherwise account. And I look at that and recognize that that's what was going on in my... It explained what, that for which I couldn't otherwise account. Why do I keep doing this? Why can't I... I mean, I didn't think, why can't I drink a little less? Or so I just, why do I keep getting drunk and screwing up? Why do I keep hurting people? Why do I do this again? My mother would say, you know, I started getting these DUIs and wrecking cars early on. That's one of the external measurables of my alcoholism and drinking. And my mother would go, why would you do that? You know, why would you do it again? I mean, you know, I'm clueless. Our book says, you know, that he may give any of 100 answers. Once in a while, he may tell the truth. And I've come to believe that I probably told the truth once in a while, but not because I was trying to. I don't think that means that a guy like me lies every time. It's that I don't know, so I keep reaching for answers. I keep and once in a while, I might stumble across, you know, the right one or something close. But I don't know. And I don't know I don't know until I get to Alcoholics Anonymous and you guys familiarized me with the problem. And I identified with it. And the fact that I've got this allergy, man, that was great news. And, you know, my mother said, hey, Steve, why would you drink and drive again? I said, I wasn't going to, Mama. Then I got drunk. I don't know about you. When I get drunk, I change my mind about stuff. You know? I say, I'm not going to do something. I have to drink. So, wait. Let's rethink that. Yet I don't know. See, I don't know till I get here to you guys. You give voice to my alcoholism. You gave me a language to speak with about my alcoholism. I begin to see things in our literature and hear you talk about things and go, that's it. Stuff I didn't know a minute before, then you would say it and I would go, that's been it all along. I read in our book where it says there'll come a time that a guy like me won't have the power of choice over drink, that I won't be able to bring to consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. I'll be without defense against the drink. Now, in 1980, in Atlanta, I'd lived down here in Atlanta in 79 and 80, just off Powers Ferry Road at the Riverbend Apartments. And that was the right time to live at the Riverbend Apartments. And I was at the TGI Fridays there off of Roswell Road down in Sandy Springs and just casually throwing back kamikaze shooters and taking two and alls one afternoon. And I came out of there and I went the wrong way on I-285. I went east into westbound lane. I hit a car head on. Two other cars hit us. Totaled all four cars, sent people to the hospital, sent me to jail. Came to the next morning, I'd urinated on myself, I'd vomited on myself, or I hope I did, because somebody did. And you know, rule number one in the drunk tank is and some of you know the rules of the drunk tank, but rule number one is find a wall to get against and stay upright all night long. But I was unsuccessful in that. But I came to, and the truth is, I had just a fuzzy memory of what had happened. And I knew that people had been injured. I didn't yet know the extent of the injuries. And as it turned out, they weren't life-threatening. I did get sued over that, and appropriately so. But I'm in the jail cell that morning, and I had never been more afraid of the consequences, legal, personally, and professionally, that awaited me. I had never been more ashamed of what I had done and the harm I'd caused other people. I had never been more humiliated than sitting there in my own urine and my own vomit. And I had never been more certain that I'd never drink again. I'm done. This is it. I've crossed a line even I can't rationalize. Even my acute powers of rationalization don't work here. I'm done. And 10 days later, I'm driving down the road smoking a joint, drinking a bottle of wine, thinking I've overreacted. Now, that's the alcoholism I've got, and I don't, and it doesn't feel crazy to me. It doesn't feel powerless. It doesn't feel. It just felt like, wait, again, I'm going to do better. And how that strange mental blank spot that could have me look at something like that and believe that that could happen to anybody. But when I get to AA and I saw about that, I can't bring to consciousness with sufficient force. See, I couldn't carry with me those very legitimate, true feelings I had that morning in that jail cell were insufficient to carry me forward. So what I've discovered for me in Alcoholics Anonymous is that you cannot scare me enough to get me sober. I cannot love you enough to stay sober. I can't want a job and money and prestige and success enough to stay sober. Those are the types of things which might incentivize me and motivate me to turn myself toward the solution of Alcoholics Anonymous. But what I didn't know until I got to AA, I was spending time, not even really knowing it, but I've spent time fighting the problem. I'm attacking the problem, and you guys said, no, don't do that. You can't fight alcoholism. You embrace the solution. You embrace this spiritual way of life, which then allows a power into your life, which will take care of that problem. See, our book says that lack of willpower is not really my problem. It's the misuse of willpower that's my problem. I need to turn it toward the application of these 12 steps in my daily living. Even in the 10th step in our book where it says that I'll be given this new attitude toward liquor, and it will have come without any thought or effort on my part. And I read that and I thought, whoa, wait a minute. I've had a lot of thought and a lot of effort since I've been here at AA. But what it's saying, at least the way that I utilize it today, is the thought or effort isn't about not drinking. I'm not spending all my time not drinking. I'm embracing the solution, and this happens. When I was in that treatment center and I decided somewhere along the way, I decided to stop drinking. I said, you know what? I need to stop drinking. I need to stop. And that's real different than wanting to stop. But I knew I needed to stop, and I said, okay, I'm going to do it. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to stop drinking. And AA's the way I'm going to do it. I didn't quite know what AA was going to ask of me, but I said, AA's what I'm going to do. But here's what I thought, and if you're new, you may have some of these thoughts. I thought I was going to spend the rest of my life not drinking. I thought not drinking was an actual activity in Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew. Those people said, hey, Steve, we're going to go to the Falcons-Titans game Sunday. Would you like to go? Boys, I'd love to go, but I'm busy Sunday. What are you doing? Well, I'll be home not drinking. Yeah. We're going on a golf weekend next weekend. Would you like? Oh, no, boys, I'm booked. You know, I'll just be home not drinking. I'll just be home not drinking. In fact, somebody said don't drink even if your ass falls off, so I'll be home not drinking, guarding my ass. And I was prepared to do it. It was going to be a life of self-sacrifice. My life was about to get very small from my opinion. You know, it's going to be all about what I can't do, where I can't go, who I can't hang out with. A lot of can't. Oh, and I'm hearing that, oh, you got to change your playmates and playground. Oh, man, give me a break. I'm hearing all, what I think I'm hearing is what I can't do. What I could not see was how limited my life was before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, how small it had become. My world, I did spend days inside that little apartment. When I was living here in those Riverbend apartments where life was grand and social activity was at its height, I spent 3 days in the fetal position, laying in the floor with the curtains pulled and the phone unplugged and not answering a knock at the door. And I'm not a guy that ever contemplated suicide seriously. I just didn't know how to live life. And I'm laying there and I know that my mom and my brother and people are worried about me, and they're sending people to knock on the door, and I can't go, and I'm just laying there, and it's finally, you know, it's almost comical looking back, but I'm about day three, and I went, I'm getting hungry, and I'm either going to kill myself or get up, and I got up, And you know what I did? I don't know if I've done versions of this, but I don't think I've told that story. I don't think about that often for one reason or another. But the other thing I did then was call all of these people and say, you know what, man, I just hit kind of a low point and I've been, you know, taking stock of my life and I'm ready. And what I did was ask for a fresh start from everybody. I said, you know what, I see it now. And anyway, I think I got this fresh start. You know, and within a week or two later, I'm just the same old guy doing the same old thing. And I don't know that I have an inability, that lack of power is my dilemma. Certainly, I tell you when lack of power became my dilemma. Lack of power was my problem before I got to AA. It is only when I get to AA that lack of power became my dilemma. Because what that book says is that I must find a power greater than myself, and it must be a power by which I could live, obviously. I get to AA and I finally buy into the problem. You're right, I'm powerless over alcohol. My life's unmanageable. And right where I said that description of alcoholism that says that when I honestly want to, I can't stop entirely, or if when drinking, I have little control of the amount I take. The next line says, if so, I may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience can conquer. That was my dilemma. I got a problem I don't want, and you got a solution I don't want. A dilemma, I looked it up, and I wasn't but 18 years sober when I decided to do it. A dilemma is a problem with two equally unacceptable solutions. The options you give me right in that paragraph are whether to die an alcoholic death or live life on a spiritual basis. And we say these aren't easy alternatives. It's a dilemma. I can't figure it out. What else you got? You know, in AA we say our program is meant to be suggestive only. And that's true. But here's, you know, if you're new, it's the only suggestion we got. There is no other solution in Alcoholics Anonymous. There might be other solutions other places. We don't corner the market. I don't know. I'm not in charge of what works for somebody else. And AA, you've told me not to tell people what won't work for them. You have encouraged me to share with people what does work for me and see if that is attractive, and if they're interested, share it with them as best I can. But we don't have a plan B in Alcoholics Anonymous. So it is senseless to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and argue about Alcoholics Anonymous. I spent a lot of time early when I was newly sober telling people what I didn't believe about God. You would try not to, I'd do it in a meeting, I would do it one-on-one later. I would tell you what I didn't believe about God. And a guy pulled me aside one night. He said, Steve, good news. We don't care what you don't believe about God. He said, you're free not to believe anything you don't want to believe. He says, but decide what you do believe and act like a guy would act if he believed it. That's where he had landed on my problem. I had no anchorage to any set of permanent values. I didn't believe anything, so all I could do was try to debunk your point of view. This spiritual life made me really uncomfortable. I don't know whether I was atheist or agnostic, I often say it, but I was at least apathetic. I was unconnected to that way of thinking, and I'd gone to church as a kid, but it just hadn't meant anything to me. Nothing bad. I'm not a recovering Methodist or Catholic or anything. I had no bad experience at church. I just had no experience at church. I just was mad I had to go because I wanted to stay home and watch Sons of Hercules on Sunday morning. Some of you are old enough to have watched that bad dubbed-in Italian Sons of Hercules, but they oiled up. I was all over him, and I just wanted to watch that show. And there was Shirley Temple. I don't like to admit to wanting to watch the old Shirley Temple movie scene. But I didn't want to go to church just because I'd rather do something else. I get here, and I got really uncomfortable with some of the language you were using. Spiritual experience made me uncomfortable. Spiritual awakening made me uncomfortable. Prayer made me uncomfortable. Higher power, creative intelligence. And I don't care what little, you know, extra buzzwords you put on it. I knew you were trying to reel me in. And I was just uncomfortable with all of that. I'm going to come back to that a little bit later. I know you're on pins and needles. I decided to stop drinking. I decided AA is how I wanted to do it, but I just didn't know much about AA. I got out of treatment and I went down in Nashville to the 202 Club. We'd gone out to meetings and had been down there, and I went to the Friendship House, which is getting ready to celebrate our 50th anniversary of that Friendship House next month in Nashville. But I wandered upstairs, at, like a clubhouse, there'd be two or three meetings going on at any given time at different parts of that, and I wandered up into a little room quite by accident or through God's grace. Where they were having a book study, and I feel very fortunate that that's kind of the folks that I fell in with. And the guy that would become my sponsor, Big Frank D, was in there, and Frank was kind of a rough, gruff guy. He was a big man, about 6'5", about 280 when I met him, and in his 60s, and sober 11 years, which I thought was just a lifetime. And I asked Frank if he would sponsor me, and he took me back in a little room to have a talk. They hadn't told me in treatment that they could have the talk, and here's what I heard him say. I don't know what I heard him say was, all right, he said, but kid, I ain't gonna be your banker. I ain't gonna loan you any money. I ain't a cab driver. I'm not a relationship counselor. I'm not a career counselor. And I'm thinking, geez, this is going to be great fun hanging with you, Frank. What the hell will you do, you know? And I thought, you know, I look back and he was my sponsor for most of 18 years, and I was at his bedside when he took his last breath with his wife and his daughters, and I gave the eulogy at his funeral. And in that time, from when we were back in that little room till he died January the 15th of 2008, we talked about everything in my life. But what he was saying was, I can't solve those problems for you. What he said was, is we'll look to the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous to guide you through whatever you're doing. He's not giving me career advice. He's helping me learn how to walk through life. He's showing me a set of spiritual tools to utilize as I go fend for myself with God's help. But nothing was out of bounds for us to talk about. It's just the approach was through these principles, not through some, you know, send your wife flowers and a card. It was, can you look and see where self is involved in this? Can you see where you're showing up and getting in the way? Anyway, and Frank introduced me, as the other folks in that room did, to our literature, and that set the foundation for my recovery. A year later, I moved to Richmond, Virginia, and while I was in Richmond, at Frank's suggestion, I got a sponsor over there as well, a guy named Joe, and Joe was a tremendous help to me in other ways. Joe's a guy that I would start to bounce my thinking off of, and that's important. You know, when we get to AA, here's kind of what happens over time, at least for me, as I get here and you guys tell me, well, your first thought's probably always wrong. You know, I'm not a big fan of some of the things we say. I don't know whether they're right or wrong. It just, sometimes I find myself just saying them, and then I got to stop and go, do I believe that? Now, when I got here, my first thought was usually wrong. But after, and so I'd call Joe and I'd say, here's what's going on, here's what I'm thinking about it, what do you think? And he says, well, let's consider some other options. Then after a while, I'd call Joe and I go, this is what's going on, this is what I think, what do you think? He said, you know, sounds pretty sound to me. He says, I think you're on the right track. Here's my biggest problem today. My biggest problem today is that my first thought is more often right than wrong. And my ego will shout that intuitive voice down. I was going to a conference in Ontario a number of years ago, and I got on the airplane. I was excited to go, probably for all the wrong reasons. You know, it was a big deal, and there were a lot of people there that I wanted to see and hang out with. And so I was excited beyond just trying to carry a message. You know, I'm human. I get on this little airplane, and as I'm boarding, I'm flying from Nashville to Detroit and from Detroit to Toronto. And we're on a little regional jet, 60 passenger deal. I don't know how many people are on there. And there's this young woman that is crying unconsolably in the gate area with an infant child. And we get on the airplane. And the flight attendant comes on and she says, there's a young lady out here whose brother has been critically injured in a car accident in Detroit. She's trying to get to Detroit. Would someone be willing to give up their seat? My intuitive voice immediately said, that's sure. Sure. Then I started thinking, well, wait a minute, that, you know, they paid for this plane ticket. Wait, my God, what will they do if I don't show up? Can I be responsible for several thousand drunks in Toronto? I'm thinking about it. I'm having this internal conversation, and the door closed. Nobody gave up their seat, and we flew off. And the thing I know is that the guy they thought they invited to Toronto would have given up his seat. And that intuitive voice was clear and concise. And pride and ego and self comes back in to drown it out and give me a socially acceptable explanation for unacceptable behavior. And that happens regularly in small and big ways all the time. And sometimes it's not till looking back, I go, damn. See, our book says that I reach a point where I begin to listen to that voice, that I begin to rely upon it. And it's clear that sometimes I'm going to confuse my voice for God's voice. But more often than not now, it is the other way around. And I got to start listening to that and be willing to take a risk on that intuitive voice. Be willing to take action upon it instead of shouting it down. Anyway, I called Joe one day and I said, I was 15 years sober now. My brother and I had bought a little building that we were moving our office into, and we were buying furniture and stuff. And we were talking with a couple other guys that work with us. We said, this would be a good time to buy some furniture for our homes if anybody, you know, just wants to buy some furniture. And we'll bill it through the company and get the tax advantages that go with that. I mean, that's perfectly reasonable. And I called Joe. I really wasn't, I wasn't looking for input. I was just kind of talking to him. And he said, you know, Steve, I don't think I would do that. And he wasn't telling me not to do it. He was saying, I don't think I would do that. And I said, well, Joe, I know that it sounds a little bit like tax fraud. And this is where I think sponsorship is really important. He went, no, Steve. He said, it actually is tax fraud. You know, that's a distinction with a difference. He said, it is tax fraud. And he said, I don't care what you do. And he says, I'm not in charge of the moral line for you or anybody else. And he says, but, he said, we don't quit making mistakes or get perfect here in AA. He says, but we try to quit kidding ourselves about what we're doing. He says, act on the truth. Make whatever choices you want to make, but don't kid yourself about what you're doing. And that's one of the things you guys have tried to teach me. After Frank died in 2008, I got Don to be my sponsor. I waited about a year. I just, I couldn't
plug anybody else in that spot for a while. But then I got Don, and he's been such a godsend for me,
and he's such a sweet, loving man, and that's what I've learned from Don, and he helps me see the world in a kinder, gentler way. I did an inventory when we went through the steps together, you know, and I did a big inventory, and I was surprised to discover in 2009 that pride was the primary defect of character that was showing up in all three areas of investigation. I'm talking with Don about this, and I said, you know, I didn't see this coming in. I said, I'm really surprised. I said, I just didn't see this pride. And he went, yeah. He said, pride can't spot pride. Pride is camouflage to pride. He said, but I bet if you ask around, other people weren't nearly as surprised as you. I think that's probably true. And see, I got to be willing to have the problems I've got today. I got to be willing. That's the humility that I believe our book talks about, and the 12 and 12 in particular, is because I'm not going to get perfect. And this is not about me getting perfect. It's a, say right in how it works that I'm going to come nowhere near perfect adherence to these principles. In fact, I don't want to break it to you, says you're not either. None of us are going to come anywhere near perfect adherence to these principles. We're not saints. What's the point? The point is, am I willing to grow along spiritual lines? Today, am I still willing to grow along spiritual lines? And to do that, I've got to own stuff about me. I got to be willing to do this self-examination and go, that's true. My friend Lee over there, we listen to our buddy Bob all the time. Bob, he says, if there's a problem I'm unwilling to have, I'll have it forever. If I can't own it, then I can't do anything with it. That was true about my drinking. Now it's been true about my life, about the way I live it, that unmanageability of my life. You know, that stopping drinking, as our book says, is but a beginning. A much more important demonstration of these principles lies before, certainly before me in my respective home, careers, and affairs. Now, I will say, Frank used to say, that's true. He said, but Steve, that not drinking part is real important. And because I don't seem to be able to benefit from anything else Alcoholics Anonymous has for me while I'm drinking. So I stop drinking, and then my life is unmanageable. And that unmanageability for me aren't the external circumstances of my life. That unmanageability is an internal condition. And it is brought on by the bondage of self. I cannot manage. I think page 52 in our book speaks to it pretty clearly for me. My inability to control my emotional nature, prey to misery and depression, can't be of real help to other people, feeling of uselessness, bouts of fear. And information, self-knowledge doesn't solve that problem for me. You've never been successful in talking me out of that. You comfort me. See, that's what a lot of time AA meetings bring me relief. I go to AA meetings and one of you guys will say something that is life-changing until I get to my car in the parking lot. And then I'm stuck with me again. The information, this is not an informational process, it's a transformational process. You're not going to teach me how to do better, you're going to model a life for me. But ultimately it's through the application of these spiritual principles that I have that internal change that our book talks about. That spiritual experience that I'm uncomfortable talking about when I got to AA. With Frank's permission, I went through my book the first year I was sober, and I marked out everywhere it says spiritual experience or spiritual awakening. I redacted it in today's terms I blacked it out, and I wrote above it. I had gone to Appendix 2 in our book, which I'm so grateful for, on the spiritual experience, and it used language I was more comfortable with. It said I could have a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery. It said I could have a profound alteration in my reaction to life. And Frank said, Steve-O, I don't care what you call it, man. I just want you to have it. He said, a rose by any other name would smell as sweet. And I get hung up on semantics. I get hung up here sometimes in AA at the rigidity that I will enforce on somebody else. What I want is to have this experience, not turn it into an intellectual exercise, but let it be experiential and spiritual. The difference is, and I'm winding down now, I promise, because I didn't know how y'all were going to have that 10 o'clock Red Ball meeting while I'm still talking about what I was like. My wife and daughter and I went to see the movie Avatar when it came out a few years ago. I didn't want to go. They talked me into going. They talked me into going on like Christmas Day when it was packed. And they talked me into going to the IMAX theater where all these other people were going to be. And I love a good movie. I just don't like all y'all to go the same day I go. I don't like lines and I don't like traffic and I don't like any of that crap. And so I go. But this was kind of began this rebirth of 3D movies. And we're in there, and we're in this IMAX deal, and I put on this, I put on these glasses, and I became fascinated at this 3D experience. And I would take the glasses off and look for a minute, I could see that it was there. The characters were there, the same characters, saying the same dialogue, and it was the same story, and it's going on. And then I put the glasses on, and it added a dimension. It added depth to what was only a height, and width proposition, a two-dimensional proposition. It added depth and it enriched my experience of the same movie with the same dialogue with the same actors doing the same thing. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, you offer me a fourth dimension in a three-dimensional world. And you allow me to have a richer experience with the same people under the same set of circumstances doing the same thing. You change my experience of life. It is a spiritual experience. You've added a spiritual component through the processes of these steps. It's not a piece of information. It's how I experience life. And I got to tell you, about half of my day is three-dimensional. And about 20% of my day is spiritual, and I'm asleep the rest. And but man, I know when that's happening. You know, we have those moments. You have them where you go, whoa! I mean, it feels different. It looks different. I'm out of the way for a minute. That bondage of self is released a little bit, not because I went, ugh, you know. Not through effort, not through information, not through intelligence, not through virtue, but through the process of these 12 steps that you introduced me to that seemed to have nothing to do with the problem I showed up here with, that I was resistant to, that I kept trying to outthink. See, I got a problem I can't outthink. I've got to surrender to the solution, not just the problem, but to the solution. I'm going to end by telling the story of, I'd said before, how resistant I was to this spiritual experience, how resistant I was to the idea of a God of my understanding, how often I spent correcting other people, telling them where they were full of it as they described their God. I wouldn't, at the end of the meetings in my early days in AA, I wouldn't hold hands and say the prayer at the end of the meeting. I was loving being sober. But I just, whatever it was about me, and a lot of this was just self-importance, but I would step away from the circle, not hold hands, and not say the prayer. And the guy came up to me one night. He said, "Steve, what's that about, man? What's going on there?" And I said, "Well," and I was earnest. If nothing else, I was earnest. And I said, "You know, man, I said, I don't want to be a hypocrite. I said, I don't know what I believe, and I don't know about, you know, all this God thing and this spiritual, you know, gobbledygook, and I'm just not going to, you know, hold hands and sing Kumbaya with the rest of the campers just because that's what y'all are doing." And this guy had heard my treatment fifth step where I had confessed. It was kind of a confessional to all the tacky, tawdry things I was willing to talk about at the time. But I talked about infidelity. I talked about stealing time and money from my company. I talked about a host of things that he had heard. And he went, "And hypocrisy, that's where you draw the line, huh?" "That is impressive, Steve," he said. He said, "I got good news for you and bad news for you, you know, and if you've ever felt condescended to in AA, it's because they're being condescending." And I could almost feel him patting me on the head, you know, but he said, "I got good news for you and bad news for you." And I said, "Okay, I'll play, you know. What's the bad news?" He said, "The bad news is hypocrisy is way down your list of problems, and you should address them in the order in which they will kill your ass." I said, "What's the good news?" He said, "The good news is there's room for another hypocrite in Alcoholics Anonymous." And I will tell you, that's as good a news for me tonight as it was then. See? Because we espouse these perfect ideals, and we fall short daily. We're sometimes going to sound hypocritical. I'm sometimes going to look hypocritical, and often I'm going to be hypocritical because I'm not going to be able to live up to these perfect ideals. But boy, aren't these a higher class level of mistakes that I'm making, aiming and tripping as I'm trying to get to this goal. So I stumbled along sober in AA and happy, but with something missing. I couldn't quite grab this personal relationship with a higher power. And I was going through a book study with some guys when I was 8 years sober, and we got to the part in the book where it says that we could evade it no longer, crushed by self-imposed crisis. God is everything or God is nothing. What's our answer to be? And the right answer to me in that book study is, well, God's everything. You know, let's turn the page and go on. But when I honestly asked myself, I didn't have an answer to the question. I knew I didn't feel like God. I just didn't know how to get my arms around it. And finally, I was able to find what works for me in We Agnostics, and where it says that no one can fully define or comprehend that power which is God. That freed me up. No one can fully define. So that means you're not all wrong and you're not all right. It means I'm not. It just means we're all free, because we're limited by our own human vocabulary to describe a God that defies human description. I can't explain a spiritual experience. And then it says that deep down within every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. So I've taken the position that that's where God's hanging out, deep within. And since he's in deep within every man, woman, and child, that has become my connection point to you, where I used to feel separate and different. As Chamberlain said, that conscious separation from God and man. Now that's what attaches me to each and every one of you. And then it says, look out, Steve. It says, the book says, what might obstruct or obscure this newfound relationship is pomp, worship of other things, and calamity. And pomp is, me, is the reemergence of pride and ego that may show up at any given time, and it blocks my God out. It blocks me from God, not God from me. And worship of other things is anything that I raise above my relationship with God and you and AA and that power. And calamity, I've discovered, might be, I went bankrupt at 10 years sober, you know, lost a house. They took our homes, our cars. I called Frank. I said, Frank, they just pulled up in a flatbed truck and took our cars. He went, no, Steve, they took their cars. Just to be clear, he said, they took the cars you were no longer paying for. And, Oh, yeah. That can be calamity. Disease can be calamity. The loss of a loved one could be calamity. Or I can get home tomorrow and the shows that I've recorded on DVR in my absence might not have recorded. And that may sound trivial, but what I've discovered is a calamity is anything I've decided can't be happening to me. And what you have done is helped me see that AA is not a life of having my demands met. It's a life of lessening my demands. I paint myself into my own corner without an understanding of how I'm that I'm doing it. That I've got an unwritten list that I don't even know. And what started as a request turned into a demand. And then there was then the book says that as I draw near to Him, He will disclose Himself to me. And clearly the way I draw near to Him then is to draw near to you, since that's where God's hanging out. So you guys having me here this weekend have offered me that opportunity. There was a fellow in Nashville, Mo Hollering, and Mo always used to recite the verse to a poem when he closed his talks. And when I first heard it now over 17 years ago, I knew that those verses describe my experience in AA more than I have in the far too long I've gone on tonight. And when Mo became ill with cancer and his time was short, and we had breakfast one morning, and I asked him if it would be okay if I closed my talks with that poem. And it would help me remember him. And in the truest sense of AA, it would help me pass on what he had passed on to me and so many others. And the poem was, I sought my God I could not see. I sought my soul eluded me. But I sought my fellow man and found all three. And that's been my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. You guys allowing me to hang out with you, a power that I can't explain or describe shows up in my life and works in a way that I can't understand. But you've offered me a life that I can never be grateful enough for, but I'm always going to keep trying. Thank you so much.